Welcome to the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Here are your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub.
Welcome to Legally Sound Smart Business. This is Nasser Pasha.
And this is Matt Staub.
And welcome to our second episode. Very excited to move on. We actually made it to the next episode. And I hope you guys enjoyed the last one. We have Matt Staub here, finally on a right mic.
Yeah, there's a little incident last time. I had a mic set up, but apparently I was not recording through the mic. It was recording through my speakers in my laptop. My voice doesn't always sound that bad, but it should be a lot more clear this episode and moving forward.
You know, it would be funny if we did the same thing and it's still not clear, but people didn't notice, I don't think. Our sound guy cleaned it up pretty nicely and did a good job on that, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Very good. So we are a weekly podcast and we talk about the news, mainly towards businesses, and talk about the law and also take some of your questions. And you can send in your question at ask@legallysoundsmartbusiness.com and we'll put you in the queue to answer. We'll make it anonymous to protect your identity. And also let us know some of the details. For example, we got some questions, but we had to follow up. So to know what kind of business you're in and get a little more details to help answer the question. Matt, let's get started. What do we have next for us?
The first story out for this episode here, Deepak Chopra suing ex-partner over $5 million donation. There's a couple of pretty interesting things in this article. I'm just looking at it again now. The first sentence describes this guy as his former pal and business partner. The former pal part is the part I take issue with. If you read a little bit more through this story, it looks like it's a guy he met and knew for a very short period of time and then decided to go into business.
Short period, it was like 1 month, right?
Yeah. I mean, I know people I've known for years. I don't want to call him a former pal yet. 1 month is a little bit, it's a really short period of time to start a business with someone. There's a lot of things you need to know before jumping into a business venture with them. And I think that he would have seen that here if he would have looked into things a little bit more. It looked like that this guy had a lot of failed businesses in the past.
Well, what do you think? How long does it take to really know someone to start doing business with them?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, just to compare, after 1 month, it says Chopra put this guy on his board of the Chopra Foundation. Yeah. I mean, 1 month. I mean, I don't know what kind of, he must have impressed him pretty much.
Either that or I could possibly see it in a situation where if you have a couple people you really, really trust and have known for a while and they make a recommendation of this guy and you meet him and you do a little bit of due diligence and everything seems okay, then maybe. But I mean, I'm guessing that wasn't the case here. And yeah, puts him on his board and jumps into business. And unsurprisingly, now there's a lawsuit because, you know, it didn't work out as planned. So that is a good question. I would say 6 months, half a year is a pretty good amount of time. I think you could figure things out by then and could do all the kind of investigative work you want to do at that point to just kind of see the history of the person.
Yeah, I think 6 months is good. But even then, doing business with somebody, you really get to know the person. You know, you can start out by step. You don't have to go into a full partnership. You can do some small deals. But this guy, Dr. Chopra, could have easily done a background check. It says, a look into Walsh, this is after a lawsuit's filed, by the way, revealed a trail of unsuccessful, abandoned, or failed companies and projects, lawsuit judgments, totally discoverable, liens and bankruptcies, of course, even more discoverable. Yeah. As lawyers, we do background checks all the time. This is stuff easily discoverable.
Yeah, and it's not even things that you would necessarily even have to look in court. You could look in the court documents, but this is stuff you could probably Google and just find stuff that pops up.
That's true.
About that. So it's even worse.
Very true.
So the lawsuit, it was filed in California, but it looks like there was also a problem with the business. Apparently, it's not even registered to do business in California.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah, how does that affect things?
Again, easily discoverable. They can go to the Secretary of State's website and search the business name to make sure it's registered. But the fact that it's not, and if it's doing business in California, that may affect its ability to defend itself in California.
Yeah, so just a huge mess all around. The more I think about it with how long you need to know a business partner, I guess the best analogy you could use is how long would you date someone before you propose to them? I think that's kind of a similar thing.
It's a good point. I mean, it depends how close you are going to get to them. If you are going to have a business partnership, who's going to have the control?
Right.
And I wouldn't want to give 50-50 control or give up control unless I really trusted the person. That's just me. That's a tough one.
That's a negotiation I did with my wife. I was able to stretch out the engagement period if I gave her more control. So she's got the majority ownership, but I got the nice longer engagement period.
Oh, nice. Well,
yeah,
you need to negotiate a little bit better there, but
it worked out though. So
short-sighted. You wanted a longer engagement.
Yeah.
Very good. I like our next question because it relates to our first article.
Yeah. I think we've mentioned in the previous episode, go ahead, send your questions in. We keep everything anonymous unless you say otherwise. So this one is from a clothing retailer in Los Angeles. Short question here. How do I get rid of my business partner? So it's a short question, but a very long answer. I would say first things first, I would look to whatever agreements that you have in place with this business partner. This question doesn't specify the type of entity, whether it's a partnership, whether it's an LLC, a corporation, but a lot of questions, the answer is always the same thing, including this one, is look to the document. What do you have in place? What documents do you have in place? What's written down? That's pretty much going to be your roadmap to how things go from there. I mean, would you agree with that?
I would, but I can't stop thinking about the fact I just finished watching Breaking Bad. And so when this question's how do I get rid of my business partner, for some reason I'm on the completely different wavelength on how to answer this question. Like, how would Walter White do it? But yeah, I agree with you, Matt, not Walter White. It's a tough one because if you don't have a written agreement, pushing out even a minority partnership is still pretty difficult. Usually you don't have an absolute right to do it. But even if you do have an agreement, think about this. Let's say that you, as a majority partner owner, and I assume this guy is, maybe not, but if you want to get rid of your partner and you want to buy him out, at what price, right? Because How are you going to value your business? Is that going to be predetermined? Is it going to be some kind of formula? Are you going to hire some other third party to do it, which can be very expensive? And I've seen a lot of times people have a third party evaluation and people are very upset that it's much lower than what they expect or much higher, because sometimes it's just about the multiples of your revenue and so forth. So actually coming up with a formula that makes sense. What I like to do is put in some provisions in there that has some more first right or first refusals or some kind of game theory in which each party bids against the other in a silent bidding war, and the higher bid actually obligates the other party to purchase at that price. And I think that's some good options for that. But this assumes that you're planning beforehand. He or she wants to get rid of his or her partner after the fact. If you didn't plan ahead of time, it's going to be a tough road ahead of you.
Yeah, I mean, you might have to pay an attorney, $125,000 to get your identity changed like Walter White did and show up. And I mean, it's been a month or so now, so I don't know if this is any spoilers, but someone always ends up dead in that sort of partnership.
Oh, you just ruined the whole series. People end up dead on the partnerships. Great.
Yeah. I didn't say who, so.
Oh, that's true. Well, everyone dies at the end. That's a spoiler. Let's go to our next article. Twitter secures $1 billion in credit line. This is interesting because Twitter's going through an IPO, aren't they?
Yeah. You see the headline, that's $1 billion credit line. You think that's a lot of money, but then you look to the actual valuation, what it's going to be, and I believe it's just a shade under $11 billion, I think, is what the ultimate valuation is going
to
be.
Yeah, 10.9 to be exact, Matt. Well, even that's an estimate because it depends upon what the final price is at the end when they go public. I don't believe Twitter's profitable yet, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think they are. I know they have ad revenue, but as far as profit, I don't think they have made a dime. These high-profile IPOs are always interesting. The last big one was Facebook, but I think this might beat out Facebook in its IPO. I'm not sure.
It's even more interesting because I think at least at that point when Facebook went public, they had more. I mean, they've had income generating pieces in place for a while now.
That's true.
Even if it started off those silly $1 gifts that you could buy people 7 years ago or whenever that was. But they took a lot of heat for all the ads that they put up.
We have clients that advertise on Facebook all the time, but I don't know any that have actually advertised on Twitter. Do you?
No, I mean, I'm not even sure exactly how it works. You'll just see, at least when I view, you'll just see a random ad, but it'll be very clearly displayed that it's a paid ad, and it'll be a couple spots down from the top. And I've heard of some of the companies that are doing it, but I personally don't know anyone any smaller business, I guess, that's actually done it.
It just seems so easy to filter out the promoted tweets, and it's hard to see value in it.
I guess the next step would be selling off lists of people. I don't know what other ways they can make money other than the ads that are on there. It's a pretty straightforward website. You know what you're getting.
But think about it. If you own Twitter, what would be your objective right now? To me, I don't think it's about building revenue. It's about just building the brand and making it seem as valuable as possible, getting as many users, even though it's not making any money necessarily. And so this is the reason why, and I've had this discussion with my family myself, is I just don't see the real value to bringing this public, and where is this money going to go to? It's just going to go to the original investors once they're able to sell their shares 6 months down the line.
Right.
Next question. What do we got?
Okay, this one comes from a personal coach consulting firm here in San Diego. My employee signed a non-compete, but I heard they were illegal in California. Can I prevent them from stealing my clients back, or am I out of luck?
These guys are in San Diego, huh?
Yeah.
So non-competes are actually, they're right, they're generally illegal. In fact, if you have it with your employee, there actually may be some labor law violations in that. So that means penalties as well. And I think there's this bad rumor that goes around that I hear all the time that, yeah, these non-competes are illegal and they're not enforceable, but we put them in anyway to make sure we scare our employees away. That's not a good idea, because that's where you're going to get penalties and so forth. But there is a way to actually implement somewhat of a non-compete, and that's by implementing a trade secret protection. We can talk about trade secrets pretty thoroughly, but generally, a trade secret is something that's not generally known to the public. There's some kind of economic benefit to you as a company, and it is kept secret. And if you obligate your employees to not divulge trade secrets, and if you can have other proprietary information like, okay, this guy's preventing from stealing my clients. Okay, he's a personal coach consulting firm. So let's say he consults businesses. Maybe certain key contact information could be considered trade secret because it's not generally known to the public unless it's on some kind of public directory. So if you can somehow get that information that's valuable to the employees as a trade secret, you may be able to protect your business. But otherwise, it's very difficult in California, at least.
Yeah, I feel like this is a question that comes up a lot in different forms. In terms of the business corporate law world, I think it's one of the more common misconceptions. People just don't, or just uninformed about non-competes. I think it's another one of those things you see on a TV show or a movie, the way people can get their plot through.
But that's true.
In the real world, or at least in California, I guess, it's not the case at all.
But other states are, like Texas is a great example. They pretty much enforce non-competes so long as it's narrowly construed to geography and time. So 2 to 3 years within a 10-mile radius, or it depends upon the business type. It has to be reasonable to that.
Right.
And there's restrictions to that as well. Like, you can't restrict medical professionals for non-competes. But that's the concept, right? Is California, as a public policy, they want to promote competition. Mm-hmm. You know, and competition's good for the marketplace.
Yeah.
That was a fun question for lawyers. I don't know, for our listeners.
It's a fun question for employees too, because they find out that it might not be as bad as they think. So
that's true. And then you have all these employees mass exodus and starting their own business, which it happens. And here's the thing. I get this question all the time too, is if non-competes are not enforceable, then how do I prevent my employees quitting and stealing all my business? And the reality is that I think you have to focus more as an employer in employee retention, making it worth for them to stay. And if they want to leave and do their own thing, it's because they think they can do it better than you. And frankly, if they're willing to quit their job and do that, then they're probably right. They're confident enough to do that themselves.
That's a good point.
Basically, when my clients ask me that question, I tell them, you're terrible at your job, and that's why your employees are leaving.
I hope not.
No, but I don't. But but there's some truth to it. Anyway.
It is a good point.
Okay, what do we got next? Actually, this article relates to the last question a little bit.
This is our class action issue of the week. A new class action lawsuit filed last year. It looks like there's some programmers and other technical employees. But this is a suit against a bunch of big names. Apple, Google, Adobe, Intel, Intuit, and other tech firms. Basically, it was revealed that they had agreements not to poach one another's employees. And this is probably something that happens, I would say, more frequently than people might think. the big names that were involved and the way that they were so carelessly going around doing it, not surprising that there's this lawsuit that's popped up about it. I believe there is something even with
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs.
He wrote an email directly to Eric Schmidt, CEO of Google, to, quote, stop poaching an Apple engineer. And Google responded by doing what? Immediately and publicly firing the employee who initiated the call. In fact, here I have the email. He wrote, I would be very pleased if your recruiting department would stop doing this. Mr. Schmidt forwarded Mr. Jobs' email to undisclosed recipients, writing, I believe we have a policy of no recruiting from Apple, and this is a direct inbound request. Can you get this stopped and let me know why this is happening? I will need to send a response back to Apple quickly, so please let me know as soon as you can. I mean, look how anxious he is to respond to Apple. Like, oh, like they sent me an email. I got to respond quickly. Does it sound like the Google-Apple rivalry that we know of?
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. Like I said, it's kind of eye-opening. I'm not surprised this went on, but just to see it actually in writing and see the things that were said, and like I said, it was so carelessly done. It's just, that's yeah, a little bit eye-opening to me from these obviously really smart, intelligent CEOs, business owners.
Sure. Well, of course, you're taking the business representative attorney perspective and looking out for the interests of the businesses. Why did you put this in writing? And I totally agree with you on that. But then it reminds me of the last question, you know, where non-competes are not enforceable because they want to promote competition. This is the exact opposite. And I understand basically what they're doing is they're getting together to make sure that there's not a bidding war for these employees and for these tech employees that are hard to find. And I know people listening right now, if you have a startup company or something like that, that poaching employees is a big deal, that it's very common for your competitors. Once you have a great programmer or a great marketer, that they're going to be attracted to your competition. And so basically what we have here is they're fixing the game, and I can see how the employees see this as pretty unfair.
Yeah. It'll be interesting how this one turns out.
Yeah, we'll see. Intuit chairman of the board, Bill Campbell, requested that Intuit be fully added to the do not call list. Please confirm that you are okay to the modification of the policy. Very interesting. I thought that's so funny.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to our next question.
All right, this is a long one. It's with multiple people involved.
Pay attention this time.
This is from a radio listener in Maryland. My roommate hosts a sports talk show on my college radio station in Maryland. While he was on the air, I sent him a Facebook message saying I'd give him $5 if he closed the show with the following line. There is no glory so great that it overcomes the tragedy that is living in Chicago. Specifically, there is no glory so great it makes deep dish pizza okay.
Ooh, okay. What does that mean? Read that one more time. What is that?
There is no glory so great that it overcomes the tragedy that is living in Chicago. Specifically, there is no glory so great it makes deep dish pizza okay.
Is this some kind of like poem or a riddle or something or what?
I don't know. It's you and I are both originally from the Midwest. Chicago's a pretty nice city. I don't really get the tragedy of living there. I know the winters are pretty brutal with the cold and the wind, but the other seasons are pretty enjoyable.
Well, it seems like the big attack is on deep dish pizza, right? Now, I know you're a pizza guy. How would you rate 1 to 10 deep dish pizza from Chicago?
If you're just rating the deep dish pizza from Chicago, it's a solid 10. But if you're talking deep dish versus thin crust New York style, it's a little bit different. I mean, this person is East Coast, so they're going to be favoring the thin New York style. I personally like, well, I like both, but I personally like the thin crust New York style better. But
okay.
Nothing beats on a cold winter day some deep dish pizza. A whole slice is basically a meal.
Yeah, I've had it once, but I was unimpressed. But okay, so I totally interrupted your question. I couldn't get past it, so.
It was a pretty weird request that.
Yeah, so you wanted him to say this line for $5, and then what did he say?
This is coming from the listener. I tell him, say this on the air and I'll give you $5. The host responds, can I say that you told me to say it? He responds, please do, but then it's for free.
So basically, you say this line at the end of your show, and then he responds, okay, but can I say that you told me to say
right.
it? And then he says, okay, yeah, but then I'm not giving you $5, basically.
Right, right.
Okay, got it.
So the listener says, no, it's off the table, and the roommate slash host responds, too late. So that dialogue happened, and eventually what happens is the person who wrote in says he hears the line on the show, not giving him the credit for it, And here's where it gets complicated.
No, it was complicated with the first sentence. There is no glory so great that it overcomes the tragedy that is living in Chicago. That's when it got complicated.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. That is true. So from the listener's point of view, listening on the show, it says he took the deal off the table before he said anything, but there's a delay on the broadcast. From his point of view, he accepted the original deal, said the line, and then time to renege. Where do we stand? Does the delay matter? Does his question, can I say that you told me to say it, qualify as a counteroffer that I then refuse, invalidating my first offer? Is this a verbal or written agreement? Are Facebook messages even legally binding? Can Superman get to Lois in time? I guess I should have mentioned at the beginning this was a Facebook message, so it wasn't just a conversation that they had in person. So it actually was something in writing, technically.
This questioner is obviously having a little fun. I mean, I think Matt and I debated whether to do this question because, I mean, $5, obviously, I don't know, he's getting hung up on it, but the question is, okay, what if this was $5 million? How would we answer this question? Because maybe that's a little bit more significant.
Yeah.
So first question is, where do we stand? Okay, do they have a binding agreement? Let's forget about whether it's in verbal or written for now.
Yeah. If you look at the dialogue back and forth, it looks like there was an offer, no acceptance, but then a counter offer. And then he says no. And then he tries to go back on the original offer. So in my view, I don't see where the acceptance was. Once you counter, that's not acceptance. That's a counter.
Yeah, because the show says, okay, can I say that you told me to say it? And then he responds, please do, but then do it for free. And then the host says, no, that's okay. I'll do it for $5. Basically saying, okay, I'll accept your original deal. And that's when, of course, this listener says, no, that's off the table. But the roommate does it anyway. I know it's silly. If there's any lawyers listening to this right now, they're probably thinking about law school.
Yeah.
Because, you know how law school, what they'll do, whether it's the books or some student, they'll raise their hand and come up with some crazy scenario that will never happen. And this sounds like a crazy scenario that never happened that actually did. So, because there's so many issues here, because also one thing we didn't talk about, what about the fact that the listener actually benefited from him saying it on the air? So he did do it, but just didn't do it on his terms. So how much is that worth? And is there some kind of unjust enrichment here? And we can go on with that. But I think, Matt, you're right that I don't think there was an offer and acceptance classically. So from a classical agreement standpoint, there was none, right?
Right. I agree. And I don't think he has to worry about getting benefited because he basically crafted the most confusing two-line poem ever constructed. So
that's true. But again, what if it was $5 million, right?
And, right.
You know, let's say it was on a big show, big radio show that actually has quite a number of listeners like ours. And someone asks us to say this question or say this statement and they'll give us $5 million. And then we do, but we don't do it exactly how they want. I would feel like we own something because our airtime is worth money.
Right.
And maybe we can put some value to that. That person that sent in that statement was unjustly enriched by being permitted to be heard on our show.
Yeah. This reminds me of Michael Scott's golden ticket thing on The Office when he comes up with the golden ticket idea. And he thought it backfired, so he makes Dwight take credit for it. Then Dwight ends up benefiting. It's a whole thing.
But. Yeah. Jim asks, does it say limit one per customer? And he's like, no, it doesn't. Okay. Great. So we just lost our profit from our biggest client. But yeah, you're right. That ended up benefiting. So,
all right. So hopefully we answered that question for the listener so he can get this $5 sorted out.
Well, I don't know if we did. On one hand, there's no agreement. So the question is, I think, if let's say he sued for damages, the damage would be equal to how much is it worth to get that on airtime, right? I don't know, maybe not.
Yeah.
But okay, well, here's a question we can answer. Is this a verbal or written agreement? Okay, every state's different, but most states, if there's an electronic transmittal, email or Facebook messages or even text messages, it can be considered a writing. It also depends upon the intent of the parties, especially there's a lot of types of agreements that require a writing and a signing. So for example, property exchange, it's called a statute of frauds. And so they would actually consider this a writing, but there are some types of instruments like wills that actually requires paper and pen. That can be different. So is this particular exchange a verbal or written agreement? Well, first of all, we're not sure if it's an agreement, but if there was an agreement, it'd be written.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. Well, that was fun. What else do we have left? Oh, this is a good article. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have one more. SEC placing restrictions on crowdfunding. These are proposed rules, right? This is nothing set in stone yet.
Yeah, they're proposed rules. I think they were passed or presented a week ago or so.
Okay.
So last year, or I should say in 2008, or no, I think it was in 2012, the Jobs Act was passed, and this opened up all these crowdfunding sites and allowed new companies, mostly through online fundraising efforts by startups, to raise small amounts of money. And there was a lot of people wondering, okay, how is this going to be regulated? Because, you know, as you know, when you raise funds for your business, it's regulated by the SEC, especially anything public. And so in this case, there weren't any SEC guidelines, and they just came out as proposed. So in 90 days from whenever it came out, it's going to become effective. But there's some interesting restrictions here. Basically, they put caps on it, right?
Yeah, there's some restrictions that got placed down. I'm trying to pull up the specifics here. Companies would only be able to raise a maximum aggregate amount of $1 million in a 12-month period. Said would only be permitted to invest up to $2,000 or 5% of their annual income or net worth, whichever is greater.
You know, these other crowdsourcing sites like Kickstarter or whatever, how are they going to verify that these users are fall into this category? I know when you have a private placement memorandum and so forth, you know, on an individual basis, you're doing your due diligence, but the nature of crowdsource is that you're dealing with a huge population. So who's going to do that verification? That's tough.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I guess it's only proposed rules, so I guess they still have time to figure it out. They got a little bit of time.
That's true. And see, the companies would be subjected to certain disclosure requirements too. And the more I'm reading this, the more I'm thinking that some of these companies, that these crowdsourcing sites, still have to be licensed accordingly, but they're going to have to retweak some of their registration requirements and when you're raising money or not to have the certain disclosures to make sure that this is done properly. This is not an easy task. And I think looks like SEC went pretty conservative on this.
Do you think this is a good thing or?
I think it is. The objective of the SEC is in general is to protect investors, and crowdsourcing, I can see how it can get kind of iffy because it seems so easy for anyone to do it, to invest this amount here or there. From a mass perspective, it seems enjoyable, but when you're investing in startups, it's a very risky venture. And if they're not sophisticated or they can't afford to lose the amount that they're investing and not understand the risk, these disclosures would be helpful. Would you go to these crowdsourcing sites to start your business?
Would I? I don't know. Probably not. I mean, I think it'd be, if I had a list of a hierarchy of where I'd want to go, it'd probably be towards the bottom of the list. But I mean, for some people, it could really work.
Yeah, especially people that, let's say if I have a product or service that I'm trying to reach the masses anyway, I've seen a lot of companies on Kickstarter, they use Kickstarter not only to raise money, but also gain awareness in itself, right? Everyone that invests basically becomes customers of your service or product. So that's pretty cool.
Right. Like the Shark Tank model of just getting mass publicity.
That's true. I've never invested in a crowdsource. I don't want to say invest, basically contribute to me. I mean, you might as well make it a donation. These startups are so risky.
Right, right. I haven't either.
Well, we'll see what happens with that. We'll check in 90 days to see if this goes through. I assume it will. All right, let's get to our last question. I will read this one. I will have the pleasure of doing so because this is an IRS question and Matt's the tax guy on this. So will I be in trouble if I have been withholding payroll taxes from my employees' checks but not making the deposits to the IRS? I plan on making it at the end of the year. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right. This is from a software development company in Riverside, California.
So I mean, I meet with a lot of people or talk to a lot of people that have tax problems, and there's certain things that make you just put your hand in your head or your head in your hand, I guess, because it's such a bad decision. And this is one of those things. So the IRS doesn't mess around with payroll taxes. And I know that whoever wrote this question, they said they plan on paying it at the end of the year, but I'm just going to guess that's probably not the case. For people that don't know, basically what they're doing is withholding payroll taxes from their employees' checks. That's money that's supposed to go to the IRS, but instead of making those deposits, they're just keeping the money. that's a big issue. And the IRS, like I said, doesn't mess around with that. And I've talked to companies before that are hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt solely for this reason. It's just a terrible idea. I mean, even if you plan on paying it back at the end of the year, it's still a terrible idea because you're going to have penalties for late payment. And these are pretty significant penalties that you can't really get out of. Step one, find a good payroll company. If you find a good payroll company, they'll handle it all for you, so you won't even have the opportunity to do this.
That's true. It kind of reminds me of making estimated taxes on your business, right? Because your quarterly payment. In theory, you could get hit with the late penalty and not pay until the end of the year, right?
Right.
But of course, if you're doing that, that probably means, like you mentioned, that probably means that you need the cash anyway. And are you going to have that, all that, those four quarters of taxes owed saved up to pay?
Right.
And that's going to be a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I just can't see it ending well. And I've seen too many of these. This makes companies shut down too. Like I said, the IRS doesn't mess around. They'll come and they'll latch on and they'll shut down your company if they have to. But yeah, this isn't the way you want to be doing business.
Okay, so you are advocating to pay taxes.
Yeah. I think it's a good idea, especially when you're withholding money from your employees' checks. You should definitely be paying that money over. Yeah, I'm an advocate of that.
That's good. So an advocate of the law, which is good as an attorney.
Not Wesley Snipes or one of the other well-known people. I mean, those are individuals, but
yeah,
you know, you get the idea.
I don't know how many times we keep hearing those people that get arrested for tax evasion because they make this argument that it's not constitutional. And whether they have a legally sound argument or not, it seems as though obvious that that's not going to be a defense, right?
The thing that people say a lot is like, oh, no taxation without representation. That was just a phrase that was said. That's not in the Constitution. So that's usually a pretty terrible argument, but I don't recall anyone ever winning on the sort of, you know, what it ends up being is tax evasion, but no one ever wins in that. It's just terrible.
Well, if they did, then no one would pay taxes, right? I mean, it would just take one case.
Right.
He got away with it, so I guess now I don't have to pay either.
Right. Yeah, it would just be the biggest mess ever.
All right, so that's our show. Make sure to send in your questions for next week, and we'll try to answer it at ask@legallysoundsmartbusiness.com. I'm Nasser Pasha.
And I'm Matt Staub.
And this is Legally Sound Smart Business. Have a good week.
This has been the Legally Sound Smart Business Show with your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub. The Legally Sound Smart Business Show is your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Legally Sound Smart Business is a podcast that is intended but not promised or guaranteed to be current, complete, or up to date, and should in no way be taken as an indication of future results. No attorney-client relationship is created by listening or submitting questions to the podcast. The podcast does not constitute legal advice, but rather is offered only for general informational and educational purposes. You should not act or rely on any information in the podcast without first seeking the advice of an attorney. The opinions expressed in the podcast reflect the views of those individuals and do not necessarily represent the views of any other individual or business. For more information about the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, visit LegallySoundSmartBusiness.com.